This is Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. You're about to hear an interview with Wake County Superior Court Judge Michael Morgan. He's running for a seat on the state Supreme Court in a race that will determine the ideological split of the court. Morgan is a registered Democrat. His opponent, Associate Justice Bob Edmonds, is a registered Republican on a court that currently has a 4-3 split in favor of Republicans. The race is officially nonpartisan, but politics is sure to play a role. With that, we'll go into my full interview with Judge Morgan. You can also hear a full interview with his opponent, Justice Edmonds, separate from this. Judge Michael Morgan, thank you so much for being here with me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And for our listeners who don't really have a sense of who you are, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. This is my first statewide run. I have been a candidate in Wake County, where I reside, based in Raleigh with my current judgeship, which is a Superior Court judgeship, which I have held for 11 and a half years currently. 10 and a half years prior to that as a district court judge, also elected in Wake County. And 5 years prior to that, having been a state administrative law judge. So overall, 27 years on the bench of North Carolina, encompassing three different judgeships, as I have been able to ascend, thankfully, through the appointments that I have received and through the voting of voters who have ratified those appointments. So now moving on to the highest court in our state, having survived a primary election in June. So I have run statewide once before in this cycle. But as you say, this is the first time that I have had this foray into statewide politics.
Now, your opponent is running on his experience. He has 16 years on the state Supreme Court. So why would you be better for the court?
A number of reasons. One is that the quantity of my experience is greater. He has 16 years of experience. Make that 18 years if you count his 2 years on the Court of Appeals. So he's got 18 years of judicial experience on the appellate level. I have 27 years encompassing those three judgeships of which I spoke earlier. So I've got 9 more years of experience on the bench. Also, my quality of experience is better than his quality of experience. I have been a trial judge, and he's not ever had the distinction of being a trial judge. The Supreme Court is a court of review. That is, it looks at the proceedings on the lower court level to determine whether or not there has been any error committed. Having generated trial records as I have as a trial judge over the last 27 years, I'm very conversant in terms of what a trial record should have, and if it is deficient in any way, I certainly can recognize that because I've generated those records for my career. Since he's not had that position, he doesn't have that ability to understand the nuance and the recognition of some of the discretionary aspects that a trial judge would employ. So that gives me the quantity of experience and the quality of experience in terms of being able to be better qualified than he for this position.
Okay, and the state Supreme Court in this past session had made several divided rulings. Now, one dealt with the election itself, this retention election, and your opponent recused himself from that because he would have been the one immediately affected by that. But the state legislature passed a law that would have allowed him to basically run against himself on an up or down vote. And so that ruling was a 3-3 decision. It let a lower court ruling stand. And that's why you even had the primary election, which you prevailed in, as you said. So if you were on the state Supreme Court, how would you have ruled on the retention election situation there?
Well, it's not appropriate for me to say what I would have done. Judicial ethics would prevent me from doing that. There is the ethical standard that judges cannot comment on matters which are pending or which are impending. And while that has been ruled upon here in the 2016 presentation of that matter, when I, as I plan to, be successful to get on the North Carolina Supreme Court, should that matter be raised again, I don't want to be in a position to have a forecast inappropriately how I would rule. So based on ethical considerations, while certainly I'd love to answer your question, but also since I am a sitting judge, I do have to abide by the standards which I know would apply to something like this and therefore should refrain from answering.
Yeah, which I know that's going to make part of this interview challenging, I think, because I want to ask you about some of the divided rulings that were cast. But you may be able to speak to sort of a more general sense of how they were. You know, there was the divided ruling about gerrymandering, about some of the districts that the legislature drew, and the state Supreme Court ruled 4-3 in favor of those, and then they were eventually tossed out by a federal appeals court. So I'm not sure how to ask this question for you in a way that you can answer.
Just go ahead and ask, and I'll do the best I can with it. I certainly understand the spirit of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, we have these districts drawn in a way that a federal appeals court has come down differently than the state Supreme Court. And we do have a very divided Supreme Court right now. We have a 4-3 split right now of registered Republicans and Democrats. So without, you know, forecasting your own position, how do you tackle something like these congressional districts in a way that isn't political?
I can address it broadly, and I'm comfortable doing that.
Okay.
My opponent is the one who actually wrote the decision which upheld those districts which the U.S. Supreme Court has now declared to have been unconstitutional. The way that such an approach should be made is to look at matters fairly and impartially and not allow there to be any political leaning of any kind that would suggest that politics is entering into the judicial decision-making process at all. Indeed, judges are only supposed to be fair and impartial and apply the law as the law takes one, wherever the law happens to take a judge in terms of studying the law, looking at the facts, and applying the law to the facts. I'm certainly comfortable speaking broadly in the sense that the legislature, being Republican-controlled, did pass legislative districts which ultimately were determined to have been unconstitutional. We do have a conservative Republican-led legislature. My opponent designates himself, these are his words, as being a, quote, conservative judge, unquote. He puts that on his campaign materials, puts it on his yard signs, and therefore lets it be known that he has a conservative view. That's a concern because, of course, we do have the separation of powers, legislative, executive, and judicial. And therefore, there should only be an application of the law across the board fairly and impartially. So while you use the legislative districts as an example as to how I would look at such a presentation from the standpoint of being a Supreme Court justice, the fact is that the overarching foundation of any case, whether it has a partisanship connected to it or not, would be being fair and impartial. So in that sense, on the Supreme Court, I would apply the law to the facts, understanding that this was certainly a very interesting, even enthralling case in terms of looking at the population shifts in our state over the last given number of years and looking at the very challenging task as to whether or not the legislative districts passed legal muster. But ultimately, the bottom line is, in terms of looking at something like that, it's one person, one vote, and to make sure that that is a legislative district, as you look through all the districts, that is properly drawn.
I know that you can't answer for any one state Supreme Court justice, including your opponent, but why do you think a ruling on districts, things like that, where, you know, I truly believe that most judges are trying to be impartial. Why do you think that it was a split decision 4-3?
Well, I just certainly don't want to speculate as to what was happening within the chambers of the Supreme Court justices. Certainly, they are my colleagues on the bench, having been a Superior Court judge, and certainly I understand and have a healthy respect for the justices on our state's highest court. But my concern in terms of how you say what I would think or how I look at it, I'm of the opinion, and I say it all the time as a judge myself, that there is not only the necessity for a judge or justice to understand that there is the need and expectation to render justice, but also that there be the perception that justice has in fact been rendered, irrespective of any of the dynamics that may come into play in other branches of government, or be it in other areas in our society. So there should always be the understanding that the judiciary needs to always be perceived as being above reproach and therefore above all the noise that may be made in other segments of our society and even other segments of our government. In that sense, when you have a situation where, as here, there is the split, certainly there's going to be the look at how the justices come down and to look at their registrations in terms of whether one is registered as a Democrat or a Republican or an unaffiliated or an independent. And therefore, when you start looking and peeling back and looking at the histories of those of us that are judges on any level and looking at the vast array of information that's available to us as citizens, not only in terms of what's been generated by that judge through opinions, but also what appears in terms of campaign materials, what's been said that has been captured online and is there for all to see. And again, with all that being said, and my opponent holding himself out as a conservative judge, there are those concerns that when you have these kinds of decisions and then you peel back and look at registrations and look at what's been said and what's been represented, certainly it does give pause for concern.
I also asked him about his clarification of calling himself a conservative justice, and he said that he was a constitutional conservative, not a political conservative, and that's how he meant to frame it. What would you say to that?
I've heard him say that in the past. The fact is, when you use a political term, such as conservative, on a political sign and on political materials, there is the obvious construction of that term that it is being used in a political way. Well, one can't have one's cake and eat it too, in terms of saying, on one hand, a political term is being used to be able to convey to voters that one has a political leaning, but then on the other hand, when one is called on that and asked to explain it, say that's not really what it means. It means something in terms of an approach within the confines of the courtroom. I've heard him say that. It certainly is an interesting take on a political term trying to be used in a judicial way. And of course, I'll just have to let the voters decide whether or not they want to believe that depiction.
He came back and said, you know, that you, in running your campaign, you have said that you would like to take the Supreme Court in a new direction. So what do you mean by that?
I haven't used the term new direction. I have used the term a proper direction. That proper direction would be to go in a way that is free of any partisan politics. I don't hold myself out to be one who has any political leaning, any political agenda, any political proclivity. I've not ever done that. And I think my record speaks well for me in that my peer reviews administered through the Bar Association, where my peers, both judges and lawyers, have evaluated me for such matters as fairness, impartiality, professionalism, and the like, have found me to be at the highest standards, which are excellent and good on a 5 description scale level. So I'm not trying to take the court in a new direction in terms of what he may be attempting to infer, which is that I'm going to be some kind of judicial activist, but I'm going to take it in the proper direction along with the colleagues that I would have on the bench who would understand, and I'm sure they embrace, that partisan politics has no place on the court, and those that say what their political leanings are as they go out and campaign, there's a need to understand that if one is prone to do that, and then one gets elected based upon those political representations, then there is the unfortunate inference that judge could take that it's been ratified to go ahead and have that kind of political view. And I'm not trying to take the court in a new direction. I'm just trying to take it in the proper direction.
This goes along with the divided ruling that the state Supreme Court ruled on school vouchers as well as the congressional districts. But when I pressed him on that, he said that it's not the job of the Supreme Court to rule based on what the intent was of the law. Basically, you know, him saying that we're not basically here deciding whether or not it was wise for the legislature to take this course. We're just ruling whether or not it was legal for them to do so, which I understood. But in the course of ruling on congressional districts, when you have legislators saying that they were purposely doing it for partisan reasons, how is that legal? I know that courts in the past have ruled that legislatures can gerrymander for partisan reasons, but how is that not taking away the rights of voters to choose their elected officials?
The Constitution calls for there being one person, one vote. And there is therefore the mechanism that in the law would dictate that the law be upheld pursuant to what the Constitution says. The Constitution has plain and simple words that are utilized in that description of one person, one vote, as the case law has construed the constitutional provisions there. So certainly there is an understanding that the legislature does have the wherewithal legally within the bounds of the Constitution to exercise some political considerations, because in the legislative branch, that is where that can be properly conducted. But in the judicial branch, there has to be a more detached view of how that is being applied. And again, this is what raises these issues in terms of looking at, as you so correctly have, there being a 4-3 political party registration difference among the seven that are currently on the Supreme Court. The fact that some of these cases that are heard do have some political ramifications, as they may be viewed by other segments of government and segments of society. And even when our Supreme Court is not looking at all at partisan politics, but instead is looking at the operation of law, but still the outcome comes out in such a way that people can still continue to point to the Supreme Court and say, in effect, to utilize it for their own views and ideas, that it is a partisan court. That's where the misfortune lies when judges hold themselves out campaigning in such a way that they have political leanings. And it's not just in the campaign materials, but it's those that echo what those materials say. My opponent has others who are campaigning on his behalf through social media, through other means of conveying the vote, that talk about maintaining a certain type of political view of matters. And certainly that's just disconcerting. I just say that there is, again, a perception that that's out there. And I choose my words carefully because I don't want to be ethically violative of my canons of ethics. But in this political season, when it's necessary to point out the differences between my opponent and me, I would be derelict if I didn't do that in this way.
Now, to be fair, wouldn't it also be the case, though, that some people advocating on your behalf would be coming at it from basically just the opposite point of view, basically saying, you know, we need a more liberal state Supreme Court, and so let's elect Judge Morgan?
Well, I've been hearing not people say that Judge Morgan is liberal. I've been hearing people say that Judge Morgan is fair, that Judge Morgan is impartial, and that Judge Morgan will give every case a fair and proper hearing and keep an open mind about it. I don't put on my materials whatsoever any kind of political leaning or agenda because I don't have one. I'm a registered Democrat. He's a registered Republican. I don't talk about the fact that he's a registered Republican because that's certainly his ability to do that. Often we associate with political parties, but to espouse a political ideology, that is different. And in that vein, while he says he is a conservative, therefore espousing a political ideology, in my view, he can explain it however he wants to, but if you put it on a political sign or political materials, it is what it is in the sense that it's presented. The fact is, I'm not putting that on any of my materials because I'm not that way. So I'm a Democrat, but I'm not espousing any political ideology. So what I'm hearing from those that are talking about my candidacy and trumpeting me, and correctly so, as being the better qualified individual for this job on the high court, is the fact that people deserve to have a jurist who has not said what his political foundation is and advertise oneself in that way in an effort to get the position, but merely people look at me and say, here's one who doesn't have that kind of foundation. He's going to go ahead and apply the law fairly and impartially. And in that sense, anybody coming into court has a proper chance to prevail.
Now, you probably can't answer this specifically, but looking at the school voucher ruling, what was your take on that, just broadly speaking, I guess?
I certainly respect the trial judge in that case, Judge Robert Hobgood of Franklin County, who is an esteemed veteran on the court, Superior Court level, who has lengthy experience and who is known as being very thoughtful, very reflective, very pensive, and very studious. The overturning of his ruling, again, as I choose my words carefully, was, in my view, disappointing. It was a 4-3 decision. Take that as you will. I'll just say I was disappointed in it. I have to choose my words carefully about it. And the justices who were in the majority ruled as they did.
So you mentioned, you know, him being very thoughtful, and you know, this kind of speaks to another case that we had. Now, you were presiding over a challenge to the state's voter ID law, but there were multiple challenges. Now, one of them was a ruling that Thomas Schroeder handed down, and it was lauded for being so thorough in that it was like over 400 pages long, this ruling. But that was overturned by a federal appeals court, and the Supreme Court then chose not to get involved. And so voter ID was effectively overturned in this election. But what did you think about that case? And then I'll ask you about the one that you were presiding over.
Well, again, because judicial canons of ethics don't allow me to talk about cases, no matter where they are, the federal sector or the state sector, I can't talk on the merits of it. Certainly, the case turned out as it did. It is apparently, as it stands right now, the prevailing law, and it's applicable to the states. And as we get ready for the elections here, in which we're already involved with absentee voting, which is going to go towards early voting and ultimately November 8th voting day, that's the law. I really don't have any view about it, nor is there any view that I can articulate about it. I've got to be careful not only as a judge, but also as a candidate. So I better be safe and end it there.
What happened with the case that you were overseeing when that ruling came down? Does that basically effectively throw that case out, or what happens?
The status of that case right now, over which I am involved, and I have to be careful not to talk about the case because it is still a case that is involved, but it is technically right now on a stay as the parties continue to evaluate the effect of the federal ruling upon the state case that is currently still technically active, but it is in a position of being in a stay.
Is that stay in effect through the election?
It is in a stay at this time. I can't say any further than that. Mm-hmm. The lawyers, and this is public record, so perhaps I can be prudent and say this much, because I do want to be informational, but again, I know that as a judicial candidate, as well as a judge presiding over a case, that anything I say is certainly being scrutinized. But I can say, because it's a matter of public record, that the case is on stay and that the lawyers are to inform me when they feel as though the matter is appropriate to bring back to court, or I can bring the matter back into court myself for status review.
And maybe the Supreme Court refusing to get involved in this lower court ruling staying in effect may make this whole point moot. But because you were overseeing this case on voter ID, the Civitas Institute basically said that since you're a candidate in this election, that you should recuse yourself from that case because it may have an impact on your election. And what was your response to that?
My response to that was that I did what I should do as a responsible judge who endeavors to not only, as I said earlier, be fair and impartial, but also actually have the appearance of there being fairness and impartiality, is that when I was even deciding whether or not I was going to become a candidate for the North Carolina Supreme Court, I sought an opinion from the Judicial Standards Commission by way of calling its office and speaking to its executive director as to whether or not I could still have the case under my purview and still be a candidate for the North Carolina Supreme Court. I was assured that there was no violation of judicial ethics, that I would still continue to be able and would be viewed officially as being one who would be fair and impartial in terms of looking at the ethical standards that apply, and got a letter in writing. It was emailed, but you know, in the classic sense, it was a correspondence that said that there was nothing that would disqualify me from being able to continue to preside over that case. So I did my due diligence. I went ahead and did that, obtained that, and based upon what I already felt in terms of my own abilities to be fair and impartial, coupled with the fact that I now had the official designation and recognition of being able to be fair and impartial, I went ahead and continued to preside over the case. But again, of course, there are those that would want to politicize any and everything. And as a result, there is that entity that decided that it would try to make an issue of it, noting that certainly it does endorse and favor my opponent in terms of wanting to see him reelected. So anything that could be said to try to cast aspersions upon me certainly would be attempted to be utilized. But thankfully, based upon my foundation and orientation to understand that there's always a need to be fair and impartial, as well as to represent the appearance of fairness and impartiality, I had the foresight to obtained the clearance that it was okay to still preside over the case.
Now, in the primary, you were the second most vote getter, and we should say that, you know, of the four candidates, Bob Evans would be seen as the most conservative. So probably people, if they were voting politically from the left, speaking purely politically, that may have split those three candidates' votes. So maybe you would have done even better had it just been the two of you. But why do you think you prevailed?
Because of the four, I was the best qualified for the position, and certainly, therefore, it stands to reason that in the final two, I am the better qualified for the position. I have a unique skill set, the ability to understand the law, apply the law, and fairly and impartially interpret it in light of the fact that I've got 27 years of that. I've been a teacher of other judges from across the country, having taught for the last 24 consecutive years as a faculty member on the National Judicial College's faculty located out in the University of Nevada's campus in Reno. I've taught judges not only how to be better judges across the country for those 24 consecutive years, but also I was recognized as having been the National Teacher of the Year for that esteemed institution just last year. Add to that as well, I've got the grassroots experience in the community. I have touted during the course of the primary and currently still the fact that I am a product of the community. I'm a community leader in terms of getting involved in community uplift programs and projects, speaking to groups, taking education of the law out to community forums, and trying to do all that I can to uplift the community and make it better. So the reason why I did so well in the primary is that I've got that unique skill set of the academics, the practicality, the experience, as well as understanding by virtue of being an intimate part of our community, understanding the challenges, the ills, the concerns of society, understanding that the law is intended to help society as it transitions and evolves with these various challenges that it has as it continues to grow. I believe that resonated with the people. My opponent got 48% of the vote. That means most of North Carolina was not in favor of his candidacy. So it does stand to reason, as you well point out, that with him already getting less than 50% of the vote, when he is the only one from his party that is on the ballot, having the benefit of a number of dynamics that played out during the course of that primary cycle. And meanwhile, I had to distinguish myself from the other two who were certainly commendable and worthy opponents in their own right. But I prevailed because the people did see and now are continuing to see, as they get a chance to compare my opponent and me one-on-one, that I do have that unique skill set that specially and uniquely qualifies me for our state's highest court.
How is it going on the campaign trail? You know, I know you came from court this morning, so you're staying busy. And, you know, running for office requires raising lots of money, meeting lots of people. So how is that aspect going?
It's going very well. Of course, I'm here with you on my lunchtime. But in terms of getting out and meeting the people, North Carolina is a great state full of citizens that have common issues and common concerns. I've been from Waynesville to Wilmington, from Newland to New Bern. And while we've got the mountains and the coast, while we've got the Piedmont and the coastal plains, everybody wants the same things, and that is to have a quality of life that allows one to live, work, and play here in our great state, and to have a Supreme Court that speaks to the concerns of fairness and impartiality, whether it is setting precedent for the lower courts to follow, whether it is routinely looking at the lower courts in terms of decisions that may be fairly fundamental or everyday kinds of cases. But nonetheless, folks want a high court representing their state that understands that everybody needs to be looked at in the same way. Fairness, impartiality, and equality for all. And so as I go out in this campaign, people are really resonating with us. We've got a very positive momentum. We've been getting a number of statewide endorsements, getting more endorsements in this statewide cycle than my opponent, which is interesting, especially considering some of the endorsements that I'm getting from statewide groups he has enjoyed in the past. But in light of looking at his record, looking at my record, looking at what he represents and what I represent, we're getting the lion's share of those statewide endorsements. He does tout the fact that he has endorsements from individuals, but you know, I'm proud to say that I've got working people, educators, environmentalists, law enforcement, and legal groups, social workers. I've got a number of everyday people that work every day and work hard and make North Carolina as great as it is. And as I press the flesh with them, meeting these wonderful people, shaking their hands, giving my presentation and my vision for the North Carolina Supreme Court, we are resonating with individuals across this great state every day as we continue to be diligent to make sure that people understand that they've got the opportunity to elect me to the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Are there any justices, you know, be they current Supreme Court justices or people down through history that you look up to or mold yourself after?
Certainly in our state, I have a great, healthy admiration for former Chief Justice Henry Fry. He was a pioneer in terms of having been the first African-American justice on our North Carolina Supreme Court, and also became later the first African-American Chief Justice of our North Carolina Supreme Court. I see, or would like to see, much of what I aspire to be in what he so well has represented: fairness, equality, studiousness, an ability to yet still remain humble, practical and pragmatic, and understand that it's not a mere aspect of being in the lofty towers of the North Carolina Supreme Court, but it's a matter of being amongst the everyday people. What I attempt to do which I think he did so well and still continues to do, by the way, as he moves about in retirement. You know, I like to take my robe off, roll up my sleeves, and let it be known that I am a judge in the community, not merely in the courtroom, but also in the community as well. And he's been such an inspiration in terms of what he represented, both as a jurist in terms of being thoughtful and applying the law equally and fairly, and having had a reputation that reverberates even in his retirement for representing that, as well as being just a person of the people, understanding that judges have the distinction and the pleasure of being able to be held in pretty high esteem in society, and that therefore there is a need to make sure that we represent that and model that consistently. He's always done that. He's always been very approachable. I try to be approachable. He just embodies what I aspire to be in a jurist and ultimately, of course, a North Carolina Supreme Court justice. And I would say certainly I would look to him as being an inspiration and one whom I deeply respect and sets a very high standard for admiration.
You know, you've been a judge for a really long time. Are there any moments or rulings that stand out over your career that you're proud of?
I'm proud of all of them because I do what I can to make sure in each case that I can look myself in the mirror at the end of a day and say that I've done the best that I can humanly do and that I was motivated by nothing but being fair and impartial. I've had a number of cases that have gotten notoriety. I presided over a criminal case where it was a first-degree murder case, got a lot of publicity in my home county of Wake, in which the defendant who was convicted had killed his wife and attempted to burn her body and taken it across state lines into Virginia. That got a great deal of attention, and I shepherded that case through some very difficult procedural and substantive matters. That's one that I remember. There was also the matter concerning the John Edwards series of cases with Riel Hunter and Andrew Young. That one I have a sense of pride because there were a number of competing interests in that case, and yet I was able to bring the lawyers together and they were able to resolve their differences from the different angles at which they were coming at it. I was able to resolve those differences with them, and it ended up being a matter that was quietly negotiated into ultimate settlement in terms of a myriad of issues. I was proud that I was able to do that. But the cases I'm the most proud of are the ones that don't get any notoriety, the ones that are just everyday cases where there are no TV cameras, there are no microphones. One that I am quite proud of and I remember very much is one in which, as a district court judge, there was a young girl whose parents had divorced, and it was up to me to determine which of the parents were going to be the primary custodian of that child. Thankfully, I had the luxury of a wonderful mother and a wonderful father who wanted to each have primary custody, but only one could have primary custody. And I really still, even to this day, think about that girl, knowing that she did well, ultimately, no matter what she decided to pursue in life, because she had wonderful parents. But that's probably the most important decision that I've made, because that's one that affects one's life and the trajectory of how one's life may go. The mother was very nurturing and very doting, whereby the father was very organized and very meticulous and disciplined. All of that was going to either way make her a success in life, and thankfully they were able to co-parent. But in terms of who was going to be the primary custodian, it's those kinds of decisions. That's just an example of the kinds of decisions that I've made along the way as a trial judge that give me the kind of pride that I have as I look back over my career and realize that I've touched a lot of lives in a positive fashion to such an extent that people even stop me on the street and at times thank me for what I may have done in their cases. With that kind of background and that foundation, it's the impetus for me to go for the highest court in our state.
And you kind of touched on the personal impact a little bit, but what is it like personally to do this kind of work?
In law school, we're taught that one must love the law. And I do love the law. I've dedicated my life to it in terms of my career. I've talked about being 27 years on the bench, but I've been in the law for 37 years because I was in the law as a staff attorney with the North Carolina Department of Justice for 10 years prior to that. So I've been in the law for 37 years. That's approaching two-thirds of my life and certainly all of my adult life. So in that sense, personally, it has permeated my very being in terms of how I've lived my life. I look at myself as being a judge 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and 366 in leap years, because it's a calling to me. It's a calling to be able to help people, because it is indeed a platform, if you will, just like a minister has a platform, a teacher has a platform. We all have our various platforms in life where if we take our roles seriously, we not only do a great professional work, but we also do a great personal work in terms of helping people along the way. So I do take my job personally, always have, always will. Cases to me are more than just file numbers. They're real people behind those numbers, and their lives may well be indelibly affected based upon what I would happen to do in a case. That certainly won't be lost on me on the North Carolina Supreme Court. I've always felt that way about any case I've had on any level, and would still endeavor to do that because, again, it's become a part of me, as it's become a part of my career, and obviously a part of my very being.
Well, Judge Morgan, we're coming up on an hour of talking here. And so before I ask for your last message for voters, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you were hoping to?
I think you've been very thorough, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be able to be here with you. What we have touched on is my credentials, my beliefs, my dedication to this craft of law. And I do look forward to being a North Carolina Supreme Court justice. I've continued to ascend in my career on every level that I have been blessed to serve as a judge. Each time I have been able to be elected and ultimately reelected, which means that the people have confirmed the fact that at each level where I have been, that I deserve to return to that judicial position. It is on the strength of that that I am now aspiring to be on the North Carolina Supreme Court. With the skill set that I have generated along the way, professionally, academically, spiritually, in terms of understanding that we're touching lives as judges and therefore need to do what we can to help people in terms of what I try to do in the community. I'm led by all of those avenues in my life to be the best that I can be in whatever I do. And in choosing to be a judge as my profession, certainly to be on the North Carolina Supreme Court is a place where I feel as though I can do the most help, because I will be at a judgeship at the highest level where I can go broad, wide, and deep in terms of making sure that all across North Carolina that justice is done for all and fairness and impartiality will reign for everybody.
All right. Well, Judge Morgan, I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for coming in on your lunch break. I hope you get a chance to get a snack or something.
I packed it up today. It's in the car waiting.
That's good. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.